Good morning. I'm speaking with Nita Crawford, who is the Montague Burton Chair in International Relations at the University of Oxford and is co-founder and co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University. She's author of numerous publications, including the books Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, and Argument and Change in World Politics, Ethics, Decolonization, Humanitarian Intervention. Today, we're talking about her more recent book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. Welcome to KABU, Nita Crawford.
Happy to be with you.
Well, first, let me say I'm a great admirer of the Costs of War Project. I've used it for many years, and if listeners don't know about it, we'll link to it on the Old Mole website. It's a great resource for tracking how the nation's resources are devoted to militarism. But let's talk about some of the arguments in your book, The Pentagon, Climate Change, and War. I think many of us instinctively know that wars and military expansion are bad for the environment, but your book actually provides the data to illustrate just how much carbon they're emitting. What is the carbon impact of the U.S. military?
The United States military is the U.S. largest energy user, and it is thus the United States' single largest greenhouse gas emitter. And to give a number to it, on average between 1975 and the present, it's been about 81 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent each year, which is larger than many countries, entire countries. Last year, which the U.S. emissions have been declining since the U.S. ended the post-9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, emissions were about 41 million metric tons. So the average of 81 million metric tons tells you that in the past they were much higher. They were around 110 at the peak. So last year's emissions were equivalent to the emissions of, let's say, Portugal.
And so you're saying in previous years, it was much larger, the equivalent of multiple countries' emissions.
Oh, it's always the equivalent of many countries. So think of it this way. Emissions are mostly driven by operations. So when the United States is at war, or in the Cold War, when there were a lot of exercises and many thousands of military bases and installations across the world, emissions were higher. So in 1975, the earliest year I was able to do a calculation, emissions by the U.S. military for operations and installations were about 109 million metric tons carbon dioxide equivalent. And they peaked at 110 million metric tons in the 1991 Gulf War. So emissions track war and Cold War. So following the end of the Cold War, emissions dropped. And then at the beginning of the post-9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they went up again. So that's how we understand the dynamics there. The more the military does and the more places it is, the higher their emissions. When the United States reduces military spending, is not at war in as many locations, does not have as many exercises with other countries or by itself, then emissions decline.
Well, we don't really have many examples of the U.S. Cutting its military expenditures with or without war, do we?
I'll tell you, the pattern is kind of interesting. There was a peace dividend in the post-1991 Gulf War period, and that's because both the United States and Russia cut their nuclear arsenals, they reduced their conventional forces in Europe, and overall, the United States reduced its vast footprint. It had, you know, during the peak of the Cold War, about 2,000 overseas bases. Through a process of what was called base realignment and closure, several rounds of base closures and consolidations led to nearly halving that number to about 1,000 military bases. So spending went down in the post-Cold War era, and the number of bases and operations dropped and there was a marginal savings. But you're right, especially in the post-9/11 war period, that is from 2001 to the present, generally the trend is even when the United States is not in a hot war, its military spending tends to go up. And it's now sort of unmoored in a sense from war. The United States gives more money to its military annually for modernization, for equipment reset, that is repair, and for increases in salaries. So the military spending has increased steadily in the last 2 decades.
And as you point out, waging war is just one source of emissions. Preparing for it is another. What's the impact of military industries production?
Well, I think of this as really three kinds of emissions we need to keep track of. The first is, as you say, military industry preparing for war. All those companies and activities that give us the bombers and the ships and the ammunition. And that's in any 1 year about the same size as the Department of Defense's footprint, greenhouse gas footprint. So if in 2022 or 2023, emissions were around 41 million metric tons, then double that and you have the total emissions because military industry is about as large or larger in emissions than the military itself. And then there are the wartime emissions, which we actually haven't talked very much about. I mean, exercises are one thing. Fighting a war is very greenhouse gas intensive because you increase the amount of activity that the military is doing to both get to the war zone and then operate in the war zone. The United States tends to fight far from its shores. Then there's also the destruction of places, the burning in 1991 of oil fields when Iraq withdrew, or in 2014, 15, 16, when the United States bombed ISIS oil fields. So that emits greenhouse gases as methane is released and puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And then there's also the emissions from reconstruction. And we know from new research done by Leonard de Klerk on Ukraine that reconstruction emissions are also very fossil fuel, greenhouse gas intensive. And that's because when you build anything in a country that's industrialized, or even just roads, you use a lot of cement and other greenhouse gas intensive material. And reconstruction can be a large part of the greenhouse gas footprint of any conflict.
And the United States has been supplying massive weaponry. I mean, is really responsible for Israel's continued bombardment of Gaza and the complete destruction of that narrow strip of land, which I understand is just in the first few months of the conflict were greater than the annual emissions of more than 30 countries. And so that kind of warfare, as you point out, not only has just the immediate emissions from all of the bombs and depleted uranium weapons and cluster munitions, but the long-term reconstruction efforts that also result in tens of millions of metric tons of CO2. You note that most of the documentation of the climate crisis begins with industrialization, but your book emphasizes the history of the US military's initiatives to find and protect reserves of coal and oil as important drivers of carbon emissions and forest depletion. Say something about this focus on fossil fuel logistics.
Well, in the 19th century, there was a major transition away from arms and legs and animals and wind and waves powering militaries and moving them places. And what happened was, first, with steamships burning a lot of coal, and eventually railroads and automobiles and so on, there was a desire to have access to those sources of fuel. So, for example, in the 19th century, the United States made a trip with Commodore Perry to find fuel in Japan, to then set up coaling stations along the way. And in the subsequent wars, coal was an objective, both to find the coal or later oil, or to protect access to it by setting up a station so you could refuel, or to have commercial arrangements with a local government or industrial magnet so that you could have access to that fuel when you wanted to use it. So, for example, in the 19th century, the United States set up in Pearl Harbor a coaling station. Pearl Harbor being used as a station for refueling the U.S. militaries continued to the present. Most recently, between World War II and, in fact, just this year, a lot of that fuel was stored in huge underground tanks in Pearl Harbor for the use on ships or for aircraft. And that actually had to be closed recently because it leaked and poisoned the water at the local joint base, Hickam Pearl Harbor, and also threatened local water supplies in Honolulu. But the use of this one place for the United States in its wars in Asia and the Pacific in the 19th and the 20th century is an example of how a location can be vital for projecting U.S. power. And the location is chosen essentially because it's a very useful place for refueling.
And certainly that concern about fuel to provide the U.S. military has fueled U.S. policies in the Middle East, hasn't it?
The United States has long been concerned, you know, since really the end of World War I, that no single power be able to dominate supplies of fuel coming from the Middle East. So the British preserved sort of access to Persian Gulf, Middle East oil through the 1960s. And then in the 1960s, the United States really took over that role, took over some British bases, added their own bases and arrangements to protect access to fuel at certain choke points or to preserve the governments that they thought would be most friendly to either U.S. corporations or to the United States perspective in, you know, the commercial world or political world. And those arrangements, those bases, those tens of thousands of people and the equipment have endured. In fact, they are there today to protect access to fuel in part, but also access for other countries to trade in general. And that enduring interest persists despite the fact that the United States is actually importing much less fuel each year from the Persian Gulf region. So from my perspective, what you see here is that all that infrastructure that was put in place, you know, over the last 150 years or so becomes sticky. It's a legacy of interests and ideas, and then it becomes something that you want to protect just because you have it. And what we need to do, I think, is rethink the necessity for those bases in the Persian Gulf, for the arrangements that the United States has with Saudi Arabia and other countries to protect access to fuel, to in fact fund the militaries and support them with more weapons as we use less imported oil from that region.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Nita Crawford, author of The Pentagon, Climate Change, and War. Nita, you point out that paradoxically, the Biden administration put climate change at the heart of its national security and stressed the potential for climate change cause conflicts. But you note that the response to these conflicts increases the military budget and the military's greenhouse gas emissions. So how can concern about climate conflict and wars be redirected from militarization to cooperation and breaking the cycle of military expansion and industrial production?
Well, I think now there's basically a consensus that has emerged within the Pentagon and in the U.S. national security community that climate change will lead to conflict, either conflict over natural resources like water or rare earth metals or other natural resources, or because people are migrating and this migration may create instability. Now, the problem with that view is that it's actually not supported by a ton of research. It's an assumption that's sort of rooted in our sort of evolutionary, I guess, analogies. We assume that when resources are scarce, people fight over them, but we actually have a lot more history to show that when resources are scarce, people buy them, they pay for them, or they work out arrangements so that you can share them. So conflict is possible, of course, with climate change causing increased stress for either, regions or individual nations, but conflict isn't necessary, and you could work as countries do to manage water resources, either to make sure flooding doesn't happen, or to make sure that there's enough water, or to help migrants who are pushed away from zones where it's no longer possible to live because of rising sea, or because of the inability to grow food. It's too hot, or too wet, or too dry. And so, what is important here is to think about both reducing the emissions that armed forces and every other part of our industrialized lives cost and cause, reduce those emissions, and then at the same time become more resilient by investing in alternative energy production, by working to store water and so on, become much more efficient in our energy use. So the best medicine here is, prevention by reducing emissions and then adaptation, that is, and creating more resilience. And some of this can be facilitated by international agreements, trade agreements, and resource transfer to very vulnerable areas so that crises do not escalate to the point where people are responding with military force. There's a lot of work to be done here, but my main point is that while conflict is possible, it's not necessary and inevitable. In fact, there are many things to do to prevent it.
Including redirecting all of those resources that are currently going to military use to more productive cooperative uses.
Well, I think, it'd be nice to reduce U.S. military spending, and it can be done. It would be good to reduce the geographic footprint of the United States. In its own estimates, the Department of Defense says that they have 20% excess capacity at their bases, so there's a way that those bases could be reduced. Right now, the best institution for responding in some instances to, let's say, fires or flooding events is to send in National Guard or the military itself. When we reduce military spending, we could bolster the institutions in the civilian sector that could respond to the natural disasters that may be either exacerbated or caused by climate change. And that's actually more efficient. Anything you do with an armed force is almost uniformly less efficient than what you do with a civilian or commercial response. So we have the resources for militaries to respond to natural disasters that are themselves caused by greenhouse gas emissions, but the military has those resources because we've invested disproportionately in the military. If we invested in other kinds of institutions for search and rescue, evacuation, and used those institutions, it would be cheaper and in some ways much more effective.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Nita Crawford. We'll link to your work on the Old Mole Variety Hour website. Thanks again.
Thank you.